Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Ma Anand Savita. Savita took sannyas in 1976 and is an existential psychotherapist. Savita was involved in editing Osho's books and is herself author of two books. I'm so happy to have Savita on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Savita, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very well.
Excellent. Okay, to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
Way back in 1975, living in London, I was reading Krishnamurti. And my closest friend got caught up with the orange people and went off to India and became a sannyasin. And I just went to Pune to visit her and to have a little holiday. Three of us, actually. We were good friends, writer friends. In fact, one of them went back and wrote a book about that experience. But it was mainly through my closest friend becoming a sannyasin. And then I came in 1976, which I thought was just for a couple of weeks, and stayed for 3 weeks and went back, and 2 months later came back forever and never went back to London.
Okay, so what was that change your plan? Of course, you went there for 3 weeks and you ended up never leaving. So what was that really made the difference?
Well, I did actually leave for 3 months to finish off. I had a lot to finish off because I had a practice in London. I had an office, I had a house, I had a lot of things to finish off. But it was taking sannyas and having a massively clear insight in one of the groups known at that time as the Enlightenment Intensive, which is actually similar to the Who Is In group that Ganga takes. Where I had a very big insight about what was stopping me doing what I most wanted to do, which was to be with Osho and live in such a place as his ashram. I was very clear, but terribly frightened, because of course it meant giving up so much and so much hostility and objection and antagonism in London and so forth. But I had a major insight, and that cleared the way and made it all possible, really. It was as if I felt as if it was what I'd been looking for my whole life. I'm not alone in that. I know that. There'd always been a longing and a searching. And I think that's why I entered psychotherapy in the beginning. And I felt that with Osho, I had found it, quite simply as if I had been looking for him my whole life.
I see. Okay, excellent. And by the way, I interviewed Ganga we talked a lot about the Intensive Enlightenment group, and she explained the history of how it came about and how Osho inspired the group to take the final form. So in the introduction, I mentioned that you are author of two books, and today I'd love to deep dive in and hear all about that. So your first book is the title is Encounters with an Inexplicable Man. I've read the book and absolutely loved it. It's basically a collection of anecdotes resulting from interviews you took with Osho sannyasins who knew him personally. First of all, how did you get inspired to write such book?
Well, first of all, excuse me if I just give the full title, because the full title actually says it all. It's Encounters with an Inexplicable Man, Stories of Osho as Told by His People. So that's just very useful, because I like to include the full title whenever I talk about the books. How did I get inspired? Well, as you know, I have been interviewing sannyasins right away since Pune 1, which is the 1970s when I first moved into the ashram. I was interviewing people. One of the jobs was to interview people for the Darshan Diaries series, which I worked on with Manisha for several years. And then when I came back in the late 80s, I had a job of interviewing people for the Osho Times. What happened was we had a particular column, if you like, called Hugs and Hits. And my job was to collect interviews where people had where Osho had given people particular, either we call them hugs and hits. Sometimes they were special gifts and sometimes they were major Zen sticks. And I collected a lot of interviews at that time, but then the whole series was cut and came to an end. And I ended up with a lot of interviews left on my computer, which stayed there for a good 20 years or however long it was. I can't remember exactly how long. So when about 10 years ago now, one friend came up to me and said, Savita, why don't you make a little collection of interviews? Because, and he was an Indian sannyasin and a relatively new sannyasin, and he said, wherever I go teaching the meditations, people want to hear stories about Osho. So I thought, okay, well, this will be easy enough. I've got 10 or so on my computer, and I'll just gather a few more, and it'll be done in a jiffy, you know. But it was not done in a jiffy. It took about 7 years. But it was good timing because a lot of people, of the old people who had been with Osho, were still there at the time. And so it was easy to pull everybody in. And a lot of people came when I put out the call. So I sat for about a year talking to people. Some people I had to talk to several times. Some people I didn't call back at all because I didn't feel good about their stories. It was a very beautiful experience and something I loved very much, but it was much more time consuming and work consuming than I had expected. That's what got me motivated. And I think what happened was I ended up with two books, two full volumes, and I realized it was absolutely absurd. There was no way I could deal with two books, so I had to, after having established the two books, I had to then cut them back to one book, which itself took another year in work. So that's how that book came about. And then a lot of work in formatting it, as you've probably seen, with the backstories and all the little extra pieces and designing it and so forth. So that's basically the story of that book.
And I can only imagine how much work it goes behind writing such book. And it's interesting to hear there were two volumes cut down to one, which produced even more work. And I didn't appreciate that you worked with Manisha about the Darshan Diaries. And in fact, I'd like to take this opportunity, if you don't mind, to give listeners a little bit of a sense of what Darshan Diaries is about.
Yes, well, they were quite a challenge for Manisha. I mean, he had given her the job of producing one book a month. If you think that I took 10 years to produce one book, or 7 years or whatever it was, one book a month. I mean, she had a lot of support, and she's a very industrious woman. And she used to sit with a little tape recorder at Osho's darshans, which were little gatherings that happened every single night, very intimate affairs, particularly in the beginning. They grew very big, but in the beginning, they were the place where people sat and asked him questions. And many of those are included in my book, in fact, some of these one-to-one questions that people asked him in darshan. And her job was to record everything. It was a very interesting system. She had a little box of about six tapes, cassette tapes, and she would record the evening, which would last, that particular part of the evening would last about half an hour, three quarters of an hour. She recorded the whole thing. And that very same night, she would send the tapes over to Big Prem. I don't know if you know who she is. She died a few years ago, but she was an extremely productive typist, and she spent the whole night transcribing the tape and then delivered to Manisha and me the copy, the text, the next morning, which we then had to proofread and edit in time so that the whole work was complete for the next evening. So every day we produced a complete text which represented one day in the Darshan Diaries. And if you know them, they do have dates on them. They show one day at a time. And Manisha and I edited them. Manisha had the job of writing most of the commentary, but she had a lot of guest commentators. I supported her in whatever way she wanted with many of the interviews, and also occasionally writing the commentary and other little stories that we added, little things about events that went on and so forth. It's kind of newsy, very much of the period, with lovely pictures. I don't know, are you familiar with the books?
Oh, yes. It's one of my favorite social books. I mean, they're so precious.
They're precious, they are. And they're especially precious because he didn't want them to be reproduced. So now they have like secret in loads into his personal advice to people, which is very lovely. And very beautiful things go on in there. I have happened to have one friend living here who does nothing but read Daoshan diaries, and he talks about the interviews at the time, not just mine, but Manisha's and many of them, and how beautiful they are, how beautifully people talked about their experiences and so forth. So, yeah, it was a wonderful experience. Very, very full on.
It's an enormous amount of work to transcribe all those conversations, especially at that pace, every
day. Yes, I mean, we had to do the whole cycle every 24 hours, and the tapes went in circles. He insisted that we were not allowed to keep the tapes. The tapes had to be overwritten all the time. It was very interesting, the little things that went on, you know, and the title. There's a cute little story about the title of each book, because we didn't know the title of the book for the month until the first night of Darshan of the month, and he would use the title in his commentary to one of the either the new sannyasins or somebody he was talking to, and then Manisha and I had a sort of game where we'd figure out what was he saying that was going to be the title of the month, and it was quite fun because he would always say something rather unusual. And then we knew that we had it nailed. Yes, it was very beautiful, very, very beautiful thing to be doing. I was very privileged to sit every night in Darshan as well.
Yeah, beautiful and again, very precious, because you preserve for future generations these accounts of how Osho worked personally with people in an intimate settings, which is amazing. So going back to your book, I believe you interviewed around 40 people from various different countries and collected the story over 15 years. And what did you learn personally from this lengthy process of interviewing sannyasis in terms of the relationship between master and disciple?
Good question. I mean, these were mostly other people's stories, don't forget. They were not mine. I did include one or two, but because I had in mind to write my own book, I stuck to very specific things that were not so much about me, except one in particular. And really, I only wrote that because people over so many years had asked me what it was like to have been one of his energy mediums. So I said, damn this, I think I'll just write it out, and then I won't have to explain it to anybody. It was a very beautiful experience for me, and I've actually written a blog about it, interestingly enough. Just, I think it was published fairly recently in our website, where I describe how it meant. It was a way of weaning myself of my attachment to my master, because when he left his body, I was in a state of shock. I didn't celebrate like other people had, and I realized I had to sort of kill the Buddha on the way, my own way. You know, it didn't happen that night. And writing the book in a strange way took me through other people's personal relationships in a fairly cool way, as you noticed, that I wrote it in a rather cool, unemotional sort of way, though I felt often very emotional about the stories, because that was, I felt, my meditation and my slow detachment from Osho the man, you know, Osho the body, if you like, more and more taking me inside into my own meditation, which is really what he's all about, finally. I mean, I am happy to write stories about him my whole life, but whatever I have left of it. But for me, it's an exercise in slowly coming back to myself and being a witness to myself in each story. And some of them are very trivial, and some of them are really sweet, and some of them are quite deep, and many of them are teaching stories. Just how the effect other people's connections with him had on me, the mirroring of that, was very profound for me.
In terms of the title of your book recalls Gurdjieff's autobiography, Meetings with Remarkable Men. Is there any connection, or did you do it on purpose? Or is there any parallel we can draw between the two books?
I think, of course, in a way, I knew that it had echoed. It's more a musical thing. It echoes that book. Of course, that book, Gurdjieff's book, is about one man's meeting with several remarkable masters, isn't it? Whereas my book is about one remarkable master being met by several people, you know, who are not particularly remarkable themselves. So the whole thing is reversed, if you like. I was aware of that resonance of that title, and I suppose because it was Gurdjieff, who, of course, I love and was probably with in my last life, but that's another story. I knew that it was going to bring up that title. But a remarkable man and an inexplicable man is a difficult word. I know I could hear you stumbling over it. Well, non-English people have a trouble with it. But I struggled with the title for a long time. I must have written about 100 titles down and couldn't find anything that really fully expressed what I wanted to say until I got to that one. And I felt that encapsulated it. Absolutely. That's exactly what it was. This inexplicable man who was so contradictory and so deep and profound and so touching and loving and at the same time tough. These incredible things that we consider in a worldly sense, we consider contradictory, all encapsulated in this being who touched, you know, thousands of hearts deeply. So, but I wanted to keep, it's interesting in a way because the title's rather cool. I wanted to keep everything cool. I think that was my meditation and my sadhana while I wrote it. There was a time when everybody wrote very florid, poetic things about Osho, and certainly in Indian culture, it was natural to sort of talk about the lotus and the flowering and the ocean and all kinds of natural things, and I wanted to avoid that. I wanted to keep centered, cool, and write about the man and let people decide for themselves without being seduced by a kind of facade of poetry. I love poetry, by the way, and I wanted to keep it separate.
Okay, so I'm glad I asked the questions first because of your connection with Gurdjieff, and then because I didn't appreciate you kind of took a long time to come up with a perfect title. And then I love that reverse relationship between Gurdjieff meeting remarkable masters and one master meeting non-remarkable men, Sannyasins, which I feel like I belong to that category, even though I haven't met Osho personally. Okay, so moving to your second book, the title is Dinner with Osho, and I believe I'm also here missing out the second part of the title, maybe, so you can add that. Yeah. And I'd say that your second book is in spirit similar to the first book. Again, you interview sannyasins who met Osho personally. However, this time the book is much more laser focused, if you like, and it presents the story of two particular women who enjoyed long and intimate personal relationship with Osho. What would you say is unique about these two particular stories?
They're women. Apart from Shunya and Manisha, I don't know many. I don't know any off the top. Jyoti wrote a book. Of all the books that have been written about personal experiences, especially amongst Indians, there are none. The Indian women have not written their personal experiences. So that's one thing. The two women are very different, and that was almost accidental. But when I saw how different they were, I realized this was exactly the beauty of the book, that I was going to show different kinds of Indian women with the strong adherence to Indian culture, which is a very narrow and difficult life for women in the main. We experienced it in the West. I don't know how it was in Italy, probably pretty tough in Italy too, but Italy has its own culture. But in the West, we experienced it, you know, 60 years ago, maybe more like 100 years ago, what women in the 60s were experiencing and are still experiencing in India. So to show some of their lives in this intimate way and how meeting and having this close connection with an enlightened master like Osho, what that did, how that affected them, I thought that was invaluable. I mean, how they came to me was really, they were part of the original batch for the first book. But whereas everyone else came to me with one or two stories, they came to me with 50 stories each, or however many it was. And I had to take a whole extra year and a half just to take their stories and get them right and go back again with them and check everything. It was quite complex. And then very soon after I'd finished with Urmila, the first woman in the book, she died. She left her body, and I had just got everything under the wire. And I felt like this was all sort of the sense of everything being destined to happen like that was brilliant. And as these stories evolved, I felt this wonderful difference between these two women and how beautifully you could express something about women's lives in India. I've answered your question, have I?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And I love this contrast between the very conservative culture of India, specifically for women, and meeting Osho, who is an Indian man, but at the same time is beyond any culture, Indian culture or any other culture. It's totally, you know, beyond the conditionings and limitations of the mind. So that kind of total contrast and how it comes together in the book is fascinating. So thanks for bringing that up. And because these two women met Osho very early, when Osho was not as famous as it became, you know, later in the 80s, I've always been deeply fascinated by the early days of Osho, when he was young and very much in the body, full of energy. So can you give us a sense of how was Osho in those days, in the early 60s, before becoming worldwide famous and surrounded by thousands of people?
Well, he was surprisingly famous at that time, although as a lecturer, as a professor. He was very robust, I think physically very strong. And I mean, in the early days, as far as I know, although it doesn't come into my book, he used to run long distances and swim enormous amount and kept a very fit body. I suppose it was to ground himself in his body, because he was probably, after his enlightenment, I assume he was kind of heading off into the never-never, you know. So I think he was very energetic. But by the time these women met him, he was already beginning to fade. And he had a lot of illnesses, as I'm sure you know. He had diabetes, he had a lot of allergies. And his particular tours and so forth, his lecture tours, were very stressful, very strenuous on his body. I think there's one story in Miller's part of the book, where it is described that the people who are hosting him in the middle of Delhi in winter take him around in an open car, because they want to see everybody. They want everybody to see them with Osho. Some, you know, the people exploited him. And of course, he was a Buddha. He still never said no to anybody or anything. So he let himself be pulled and pushed and fed all the kinds of things he didn't want to eat. And there's one story of a woman who sort of shoves food in his mouth, and another one who bites his toe, and all kinds of strange things that went on. And as a man in the world, he accepted everything. What you see is this incredible allowing things that disturbed his body to happen around him. And I think it probably would have been Lakshmi or his caretakers who began slowly to realize that he needed protection. And he also was very clear what he wanted with an ashram. I don't know whether you noticed, there's one story, and I actually don't remember whether he said it to Shobhana or to Urmila, where he outlines his plan for an ashram. And it's fascinating for me, because I lived in that ashram, that he outlines exactly what he wants and why he wanted it. And he actually did exactly that. I mean, he was incredible. And when he planned something, he completely fulfilled the plan. So at some point, it must have been decided that he needed to be in retreat, he needed to be protected and restrict his life, which is what the ashram did for him. It both enabled him to work with the same group of people and go deeply with them, with us, if you like, to have a focus of people, and also to protect himself from being overwhelmed by the very, very enthusiastic disciples in India, you know, as they were. They were very kind of, they would drop at his feet and, you know, grab hold of him, you know. So he needed protection. And I think that's what led him to be in an ashram. And before that, to have people like Shobhana was to caretake him, to look after him when he traveled, to make sure he got the food he needed and so forth, was properly looked after. I don't know if that's answered your question. I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it, of course, there are many aspects, but it explains a lot. And it explains to me also the fact that, as far as I understand, Osho, after Pune and Rajneeshpuram as well, he was living a very private life. And that's probably, as you say, is to protect him, because his body was becoming more and more frail compared to the early days, where he was exposed to all sorts of things. So as you outlined, so that makes sense. So, and people...
Yes, I actually should probably get that clear. My understanding, and of course it's just my understanding from everything I hear and have read, is that when he was traveling around India in the 60s, the time when Urmila and Shobhana knew him, he was really collecting his people. He was, I don't know, he went and he would go and talk about Gandhi, for example. There's a beautiful story there where he would talk about Gandhi. In the beginning, he would draw all the Gandhians towards him. And then once he'd got to all the Gandhians, he would then start slamming Gandhi. And then he would lose. 90% of the Gandhians would go, and the 10% that were left were, in quotes, his people. And he did that not just with Gandhi, but of course with all the things he talked about, the Upanishads and the various religious spiritual texts, the sutras. He got the people to whom those particular scriptures were, who were attached to those particular scriptures, and then he slowly slammed them and got rid of all the people who were there for the scriptures and not for Osho. And that's how he filtered out his people, so that by the time he decided to have an ashram, he felt he had his people, and now he needed to work differently with them. And he didn't need to work so much personally. He could now work at a distance, you know, being secluded in his room, in the context of an energy Buddha field, he called it, a Buddha field, an energy field, where the work would happen of its own accord to some extent.
Wonderful. And also makes me think that at some point, at least is my perception, I think when he came out of the silence, and you know, he was in silence for 3.5 years approximately, and then when he started speaking again, he was so fiery, and he kind of went against all religions and all the previous masters in a way that it was a dramatic change of direction compared to, you know, other discourses. And I felt that somehow that was another phase where he was kind of getting rid again of people who were there not for the good reasons. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, I think that's a very fair assumption. He was doing that continuously throughout his working life, and that was one phase of that. You know, and I think he was constantly pulling people in and then chucking them out to try and get people, pull the rug. I mean, on the ranch, he really did pull the rug from under us. I mean, taking away the orange, we were strongly identified by that time with our orange clothes and our mala. And then suddenly from one day to the next, he says, you don't need to wear them anymore. You know, it was just many ways in which he pulled the rug from under us. Our identification with him, with being his sannyasins, his disciples, and how important that was because we loved him so much. He had to work very hard to help us separate ourselves from him. I think I've said what I need to say about that. Yes.
Okay, so people who have not met Osho in person and know him through videos may get a certain image of Osho on the stage. How would you describe Osho, the man behind the scenes of the public figure?
Good question. He was a very simple man. He had simple tastes. He was not attached to anything, so it didn't really matter. I mean, people saw the Rolls Royces and then he turned his back and never looked back on them. I think there's actually a story in Encounters with an Inexplicable Man from one of his drivers of how Osho never went to visit his Rolls Royces in the garage. He was absolutely not interested in them. He just wanted to drive them and show them off. So he was all his public persona was public persona. From the very beginning, he tailored it all the time to his audience. He changed what it is, the image he wanted to project. Inside, this was an enlightened being. He was a massive vortex of extraordinary fire and love and incredible compassion, deep understanding, an incredible capacity to see what you needed, what individuals needed at any given time. He had a way of, and we all, I came with completely knowing almost nothing about what that was all about, Indian spirituality, nothing. I didn't know anything. He had a capacity to see what our egos were doing. He probably, presumably, saw our auras. He immediately sensed what we needed in every moment, in as much as he gave us individually that attention. And it nearly always happened in Darshan, in Pune One. I'm sorry, I slightly lost trail. What was your question again? What was he like behind his persona? A very simple man. He ate very simple food. He basically ate the same food almost every day. And then occasionally he would experiment with something. he never went anywhere, as you know. He watched movies. I heard that Patton, is that, I heard that Patton was one of his favorite movies. I have no idea why. I've never seen the film. But very ordinary taste. Before he went into seclusion, when he was on the road lecturing, he was incredibly well educated. I mean, he was erudite. He read, I don't know how many books a day, 10 books a day, and he taught himself English. I've seen some of those books in his library. When he had an English language book before, while he was teaching himself English, he would underline every single word he didn't know. He would write the Hindi translation in the margin. And you've got to imagine what it was like in the 60s to do that. We couldn't click on a dictionary, you know, in our IMAX dock. He had to have a book, a dictionary, and he had to go to every single page with every single word and check the meaning and then write it in the book. And he did that diligently and very aesthetically, I have to say. He used to use different colors and he taught himself English that way. And he was very much then learning about the Western mind. You know, he read all Western philosophy, and he read the Bible, of course, in depth, educating himself as to who these people, what their culture was like, these people who were going to come and be with him. But by the time he'd done that, as I said, reading 6 or 8 books a day, and he would lap them up. I mean, I'd see those books going into his house. It was a never-ending trail of books, and he never seemed to tire of them. And as you know, his library has, I don't know what the figure is, but it's absolutely enormous, 60,000 books or something. So very highly educated, really only for us. You know, he wasn't interested in education and knowledge at all, really, for himself. It was all so that he could be available at the highest possible level for the people who would come to him. He was extraordinary. And underneath, behind all that, was just a man who liked his dal and rice and occasionally ate pearl onions on the ranch. I used to grow his pearl onions, and loved to drive a fancy car. You know, he loved Rolls Royces. Not a very imaginative, since it was exactly the same model. Each 80 of them, however many there were, 90 of them, they were all the same model. So this wasn't a man who was passionate about cars. He just loved to drive a Rolls Royce and make a big fuss so that everybody in the world would know about him. He actually said somewhere, I want to be sure that everybody who is looking for me cannot say they had not heard of me. Something like that.
And I think he definitely achieved that. He succeeded for sure. Yes. And thanks for adding the details of how Osho used to study and take notes, because we spoke about Osho books with Kavisho, who was in charge of sorting out the books in Osho's library.
Yes.
And so we have a whole episode on that. But, you know, these small details are really meaningful and it's wonderful. So the last question on this second book, it's interesting to notice that you tell the story of two women with Osho, and you yourself are a woman. Osho and women is a huge topic, and Osho had huge respect for women, and in fact he tried a unique experiment putting women in charge of his communes. So what did you learn about Osho and women through the stories in your latest book?
I think that he didn't treat them any differently from anyone else, for one thing. You know, he didn't have any of the taboos that would have happened between those women and other men. He was absolutely natural about them, and one of them has a sort of sexual fervor for him. He deals with it, to me, absolutely exquisitely. I you know, he deals with her needs in a way that he did with everyone, of course, but he understood her needs and he gave her to what extent she needed it before he could enter into her world and teach her meditation. I'm not exclusively homing in on the woman aspect now. His understanding of women was extraordinary. I mean, even I had come from a very liberal and progressive kind of background to start with. I had had a fortunate life. I felt that Osho understood women, unlike anybody I had ever met, and was deeply moved by the various things he understood about me as a woman. And I can see that is how he attached himself to both both those women, or they attach themselves to him. If you remember, Urmila, the first woman, is a scholarly and rather distant, distant from her own heart, from her own feeling center. And Osha was surrounded by very loving, simple housewives, you know. He wasn't surrounded by intellectual women. So he dealt with every woman differently according to what she needed. But his understanding of that was so deep, he gave Urmila the opportunity to write a book about him, for example, probably something that she relished because that was her way of working. And then he slowly, having got her in that corner, so to speak, of writing the book about, then he drew her further into her own feeling center, into her heart. Whereas Shobhana, it was the opposite. He had to, she was a highly emotional, very needy, very spirited woman who had a very difficult childhood. And he nourished that need in her and then slowly took her into her center so that she could be more centered. So, except to say that there were many women at the time, I understand, who were really in love with him. It wasn't just Shobhana, who were desperately in love with him. He was not, when I met him, I didn't feel any exuding any sexual energy at all. He was very, he was beyond man and woman, actually. That was really what we felt. There was a feminine masculinity about him, or masculine femininity, I don't know what to call it. But his understanding of the feminine was just rich beyond belief. Yeah, especially at that time. Now it's you know, it's been assimilated into the culture much more now.
I've heard this before from other women that, you know, the way Osho understands women is more than any other woman can understand. It's almost if he understands women more than women, you know, that's some of the comments from women. Of course, you know, I can't comment on that. So we are heading towards the end. And before I ask you three final questions, I'd love to hear what are your latest projects and if you're working on anything in particular or perhaps a third book.
Well, I'm actually working on the most difficult book of all, which is the book that he told me to write in the 1970s, which is a diary. It's actually a diary of my life in the ashram, because I was, you have to understand something about my psychopathology. Apart from being a psychotherapist, a psychoanalytic therapist, I was a compulsive writer. And that's why he gave me this work in the Darshan Diaries. He gave me the opportunity to work with my writing. I was a professional woman as a psychotherapist, but I'd never worked with writing. I'd published a few stories and plays and things, but not much. And he gave me an opportunity to really learn and experience because I had no skills whatsoever. I just had this passion for writing. Sorry, I've lost track. So what was I talking about?
About your latest projects, and I believe you're writing a third book, which is interesting to hear that Osho gave you this task in the 70s, and it's actually not the first book you wrote.
I knew that. I forgot about it because I have resistance, a tremendous resistance to it, which is a difficult thing. Interesting. The story of how it got to me, why I still have it, is interesting because I wrote it in passionately 1,500 foolscap pages, which is legal science pages. I was commissioned to write it in the sense by the Ashram publications department. And then somewhere towards about 4 months before he left, I was told to hand it over, which is something that was probably quite painful to do when you've written this intimate diary for 5 years. But I don't remember having a problem with it. I remember packing it all up, all 1,500 pages of it, and handing it over to the publication department. And then I thought that was the end of it. I would never see it again, and that's fine. Whatever happened, happened. And I'm talking about a year or 18 months later when I'm out in the fields in Rajneeshpura and probably planting the pearl onions, for sure, or whatever it was, the potatoes or the carrots, out in the fields, I get this message that I must go into town to the publications department because they'd found a trunk full of manuscripts and I should go and claim mine. My mom is there, I should go and claim it. So off I go into town. There I go into a room. It's completely empty. I'm the only one there, and there's a trunk full of manuscripts, and there's a big bin, as far as I remember, a big bin, and an invitation to dump everything. And I take my manuscripts out and I dump them in the bin, and just at the very last minute I had this idea, no, I better check them, I better have a look, maybe there's something good in it. And I flip over through a few pages and I realize actually there's some very nice stuff here. So I take it all out again and I carry this big parcel over to the post office, which is like about 10 yards away. And I pack it all up in the post office and I ship it to London, where it goes into my sister's basement for 20 years. And then this is how the manuscript came back to me. 20 years in my sister's basement, another 10 years in my nephew's attic. And I'm here in Pune, and my friend Devika, who you probably know from her book, Love Song for Osho, she told me that if I had anything from Pune, a diary from Pune 1, I should definitely do something about it. And I couldn't think of anything I'd like to do least. And I said, but anyway, it's stuck in my nephew's attic in the middle of London, and who's going to go there? And she said, I'll go there. And this woman, to my amazement, who was staying a long way away, went all the way to this very difficult part of London to reach, went to my nephew's attic, packed up this manuscript, and posted it to me in Pune. So when it arrived, I dumped it in a trunk and again neglected it. So when finally the people at Dancing Buddhas said they wanted everything to do with Osho, everything I had, I remembered the manuscript, and then I realized that existence wanted me to do something about this. So that's what I'm working on now. It's incredibly personal. It's very in your face. It's not, it's the opposite of encounters, if you like. It's day to day, and sometimes just about my inner life, because I was, as a compulsive writer, a bit like Maduri. Maduri is another compulsive writer, but she's a much better writer than I am. I wrote this stuff about what was going on. And because I was Osho's medium, I had the unique opportunity to write about being a medium, an energy medium, which most people would say would be impossible to write about, and is. But because I was unable to not write about it, I wrote about it. So there you go. And that's what I'm working on now, to bring it to a close. I'm working on this huge document, which is incredibly entangled, trying to reduce it from 1,500 pages to 300 pages. And that's quite a task.
Indeed. And look forward to reading your book when it's ready. And I hope it's going to be ready soon. So where people can find you if they want to know more about you or get in touch with you?
Oh, you can give my email address if people want to get in touch with me. I have no problem with that. I don't use Facebook, I have to say. I'm a bit phobic about online communication, so I just prefer to do, I'll do WhatsApp, I'll do email, and then I'll just try and do my work in between.
Okay, great. And perhaps I can link the Dancing Buddha's website. Would that be okay?
Absolutely, please do. In fact, okay, you probably better get my correct name, because although my son's name is Anand Savita, the book is published under the name of Savita Brandt, which is what I call myself now. So, I mean, I'm still definitely a sannyasin, but I don't use my sannyas name anymore, in the full sannyas name anymore. So the books are both published under Savita Brandt, and definitely give the website. I would love that. I would love people to read my blog, which I share with Shruti, by the way. Shruti and I alternate, which is kind of interesting. I'm an English woman living in India. She's an Indian woman living in England. So we have an interesting contrasting angle for life.
Okay, so I've got three final questions for you. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Oh, painful and slow. I get up very slowly. I'm always in pain in the morning. I have rheumatoid arthritis. So I get out as early as I can. I try to get moving as early as I can. And I generally go to a local cafe, and that's where I sit for a while. And I have breakfast, and sometimes I meet friends, and this time of year, not many. And that's my beginning. That kickstarts my day, because I have to move my body. Yeah. Read the paper, by the way, also, because for my blog, I like to write things that are triggered off by the news. So I tend to read the paper and then get ideas from the paper and then bring them back to write my blog and get on with my book.
The second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Ah, that's an interesting one. If I were fit and young, I would say dynamic is the most dynamic of meditations. It's absolutely brilliant. I don't feel, even if I were fit, that I would do it now, because I don't feel it's appropriate for me anymore. So basically, Vipassana, sitting and watching my breath. But also, I have my own little meditation that has somehow emerged from my darshan days in Pune 1, which was which I kind of call, I call it the still I meditation. I don't even know. I think there is a real meditation like that, but somehow it came to me, where I focus on some, often in a public place. I that's why I like to go to the cafe. I like to sit in a public place. I like to watch what's going on around me. I like to focus on some natural thing. Usually it's a tree or a palm or something, and slowly make a circle of energy, which is going inwards. And then I go inside and then I go out and I go in and I go out. I open my eyes and I shut my eyes and deepen my breath. This, for some reason, it's something to do with nourishing myself on the energy that's in a crowded place. I've not really articulated it very much, so it's the first time I'm articulating it now. I like to be alone in a public place, and then I kind of home in on the people and on the energy, and then I feed it in, and then I feed it out. It sounds rather strange. Sorry, it sounds a bit odd. I call it the still eye meditation. I don't know why.
That's great, and if it works for you, then wonderful.
And it's mainly about seeing, of course, it's mainly about seeing what's going on in me and what's going on in me, of course, and what I'm feeling and seeing and how it's affecting me, and then taking the energy of what I'm seeing and feeling and taking that back, and it's just a sort of deepening process. Yes, no, that's it.
Okay, so the last question is, you live the OSH experiment. You were one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2019?
It's a very interesting question. I was talking to somebody this morning. I don't know that I have a map or any language to say. I don't know what I could say, how that is different from anything else. I feel very much I have imbibed Osho. Osho is like part in my bones in some way. I'm not a great, you know, meditator. I never go on retreats. I'm not interested really in a lot of that kind of stuff. Doesn't do anything for me anymore. I feel Osho is the light that took me inside, and I'm much less focused on him. There are moments when, of course, I get very emotional thinking about him, but in the main, I don't even listen to his discourses anymore. I read bits of him. I get touched. I feel like I'm a bit of him. I'm a bit of him. I'm one of his many tentacles in the world, you know, a small bit. And that's just what it's all about. I could never. So I actually don't know how to answer the question. Does that make any sense?
I think you did answer the question very beautifully, actually. And, Osho, I think he said it in various occasions that, you know, when I'm gone, I will dissolve in my people. And I think one of the ways in which he did that is what you just described. So that's beautiful. And also that's the end of the interview. So, Savita, thank you so much for being part of this Love Osho podcast. And I will link your books and the website for anyone who is interested to read this amazing story that you collected. And thank you so much, and I send you lots of love.
Thank you, Sam. Okay, love to you.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Love Osho podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit loveosho.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.